Hi, welcome to episode number 64 of Light the Eye, presented by the U of I Credit Union. I'm Scott Beatty.
I'm Robert Rosenthal.
And we are here in the Center for Innovation and Teaching and Learning inside the Armory on the campus of the University of Illinois, where there's plenty of hustle and bustle, Robert. It's the first day of classes.
It's once again presented with that... What do you do when this car is coming here and does the bikes usually don't stop for the stop sign. So I can go because those people aren't walking yet, but I probably need to stop if that bike doesn't stop at the stop sign, even though the car is waiting for me. I just had that entire example, that entire experience 15 minutes.
Campus is the only place where pedestrians absolutely rule.
Yes, yes. And people, even on the crosswalks that aren't like diagonal, you know, most of the Green Street, they'll now stop on all directions and you can walk catty corner. Now we are fully like, even some of the stop four-way stops, people just yeet.
I was told when I first came to campus many years ago that pedestrians just, you just go when you want to go. Yep. Everyone else has to stop for you, which is good because, you know, we value life.
Yes.
Human life has some priority.
Yes.
But I feel like in other places of the rest of the world, you know, if you're a pedestrian, you wait for traffic. Not here.
Look, I've been on a bicycle before, and I've gone through stop signs before, right?
Wait a minute.
Listen, everyone, I've been on a bicycle before.
Wow.
Breaking news.
Wow, Robert, you are so learned.
I'm just saying that I have not stopped at stop signs on a bike because it's annoying. But the bikes not stopping at stop signs here just throws the wrench of all wrenches into a cars in four directions, pedestrians in eight directions. How do you make it all work? You can't, is the answer.
Okay, now first day of classes, I'm going to ask you a question. And mind you, I'm married to a faculty member.
Yes.
At Parkland.
Mm-hmm.
So I know there's a wrong way to answer this question.
Okay.
But do you go to the first day of classes?
Did I?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Really?
As a freshman, I absolutely did.
What? And then you learned?
Listen, I had a thing. I'll tell you, ready for a story? It won't be very long. I had a math lecture for Math 120. I had to take fall of my freshman year. Like the second week of class, I slept in, and so I was going to miss it. And I ran across campus. I remember the route I was running across campus because I was going to miss class. I had no concept that a lecture like that, you could just talk to your friend and get the notes or see what the... I thought I was in huge trouble because I was missing a lecture. And I did. I ran and then like out of breath got to the class like 12 minutes late.
But then later, did you go to first days of class?
I always went to first days. I remember going to... we always have class on Wednesday before Thanksgiving. I went to an econ lecture on Wednesday for Thanksgiving. Maybe 300 people in the lecture. There were like 12 people there that actually showed up. They don't even try anymore. But I was, freshman year, I was that kid of like, you're supposed to go to every class, so I'm going to go to every class. So I did. It wasn't until senior year.
I always resent that some years back now, they made the change where the entire week of Thanksgiving is off.
Yes.
And it always made no sense that you had class through Wednesday, and then there's a bunch of people who it's so far to get home.
Yep.
You know, I lived relatively close in the Chicago area, but there's a lot of people that live across the country or from another country, and like, no, what am I supposed to do?
Yep.
And try and navigate airports and all that. But I always feel like now I just like, hey,
yeah.
In my day,
yeah,
we went to class through Wednesday of Thanksgiving.
Yes.
And I resent that.
A 1 p.m. class on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, and then I headed home.
But I can tell you, if you want to drive a professor nuts, mm-hmm. just say, I don't need to go to the first day of class.
Get the syllabus and go home.
Yeah, it's just mm-hmm. the syllabus day.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do anything.
Mm-hmm. No, I always went. I was a good little soldier.
Well, I always did, too. And then, I mean, later, I was in a lot of music rehearsal, so it was class basically based on being there.
Yes, so. yes.
Could you get me the notes on the phrasing for mm-hmm. this section? So, you know,
I'm going to give you two very quick stories based on that.
Okay.
They're going to be very quick.
Oh, I'm excited.
One,
see, look at me.
One, Hort 201. So for the Hort classes, horticulture, that was woody plant identification. Woody plants, of course, are those with sticks and twigs, if you will, trees and shrubs. It was a lab where you walked around the city of Urbana and just looked at, like, this is a pin oak. This over here is a, this, here's the genus, here's the species. You would learn your plants this way. There were a couple times little Robert learned you could show up at 8, sign the sheet, and then the TA who did the walk really didn't keep track of who was still there. So I would get up, drive across campus, double park, go in, sign the sheet, start like I was on the walk, peel off, go back to the car, go back to my bed, go back to sleep to get credit for being on the walk and hope they didn't see me missing.
You know, we are producing this show right here in an academic building.
Oh, I can get better with the second one.
Go ahead.
Here's the second story. I've told this on here before.
Sir, your credentials are being revoked.
This was a plant bio class, plant biology something in the spring of my freshman year. I had a night in the May or, no, it was probably still April. It was the final, like, test before finals. Had a thing at my fraternity, might have slept in till noon and completely missed my test. Just completely missed the test, woke up at like 11:45, the class was at 10. And so I did nothing about it. I didn't talk to the professor. I didn't know what to do, so I just ignored it and hoped it went away. 10% of my grade, a zero. I didn't go beg, like, can I take the test? Can you just take 10% off or something? Because I'm for late fee or whatever. I just left it alone, took the final, and got a D.
You're kind of like George Costanza, like, I'm just going to show up to work. Like, yes. Nothing happened.
Yes. Was that wrong? Should I not have done that?
All right. Well, for those of you who haven't skipped ahead already, you might be interested to know what we're going to talk about this episode besides Robert's
academic casualties.
Or casual academics.
Yes, good point. That's a much better way to put it.
On Saturday, there was an open practice for Illinois football. We've got thoughts. We definitely have thoughts and questions as football season is around the corner. Also, the non-conference schedule for men's hoops is out. We now know everybody that Illinois will play, and we know some of the teams and the dates that they will play. How's that? So that is coming up. And then we've been talking now for a couple weeks, soccer in season.
Yes.
But later this week, this Friday, in fact, it's volleyball season. Mm. And right here in this room to get us ready, Chris Thomas, the head coach of the Illini. He's starting his 10th season, so we'll welcome him as a guest.
Excellent.
But before we do all that, what do we do, Robert?
We need to light the air.
For the first and only time this year in the preseason, we got to see the entirety of a football practice. And with that comes the opportunity to draw wild conclusions based on seeing 2 hours of a football practice. But I do feel that it was very beneficial.
I do, too. Yes. I mean, there were no open practices like this in the spring, and there was no spring game. So this is the only time we have seen 11 guys on one side of a field line up against 11 guys facing the other direction doing these things called football plays. So wildly informative compared to everything we saw in the spring and everything we've seen in the summer so far.
Yeah, that said, I felt like there weren't massive conclusions to be drawn, but there were, I noticed. So you've had a couple of days to sit with it. I'll start with your thoughts. I had a few things I noticed that I thought were interesting. But let's all face it. People want to know what you thought.
Let me preface it with what I call my PJ Fleck rule. I don't know why I used Fleck for this, but it's my PJ Fleck rule.
Are you going to get out an oar?
I will not share anything PJ Fleck could use to prepare for a game against Illinois, even though we don't even play Minnesota this year. Doesn't matter. He's my guy that I focus on of, like, if he were out there digging for information, could he find, could he scout Illinois better by reading something I wrote or seeing a tweet of mine or hearing something on a podcast? So if I sound vague, it's the PJ Fleck rule. All of our opponents, and yes, they do scour what opposing media has said and reports coming out of practice and things like that. And so I never, ever want to be the person responsible for tipping anything away from my team. So I stay pretty vague with it all. So I have to stay, I have to say that because I don't want, you know, if I sound vague, it's intentional because I don't ever want to be part of a scouting report.
Well, that rule doesn't apply to me, and I found the playbook. So here are the first 10 plays we're going to run. No, I'm just kidding.
You could be that Wake Forest guy who then gave the playbook to the opponents.
There's a name behind every policy, isn't there?
Yes. Okay, so let's go back.
What was encouraging to you?
In a vague,
totally nondescript way.
Yes. We have to acknowledge that guys like Xavier Scott, Matt Bailey weren't out there in 11-on-11 drills. There comes a point in some practices, and I think the fans would like this, is like, hey, look, you don't we don't need to risk him stepping on somebody's ankle or whatever kind of anything. They are good. They're coached up in the new scheme. They've run through it at these practices. No reason in 11-on-11 to get them hurt.
To borrow from our discussion at the start of the show, they don't need to go to every class.
Yes.
They can get notes.
Yes, yes. This was syllabus day, and they skipped. They did not run across campus because they were late for math lecture.
Yeah. Yeah, the guys on the Devo team, you better be there.
Yes, yes. And there's also the thing of, okay, the coaches know what they have in Daniel Brown at this new linebacker position built for a hybrid guy like him. Let's see what Mason Moragan can do with the ones. There's also that kind of thing that happens. So you'll see reports coming out of practices of like, oh, so-and-so was the first string. Well, maybe, but he was also maybe just the coaches wanted to give him some run with the ones just to see how things go. So depth chart wise, it's hard to really tell what's going on. But I was very interested in seeing how they kind of rotated in the defense, and that was kind of fascinating to me.
I look at it this, and I brought it up in a previous episode. They have a travel roster where they now this year they can take 80 guys. By watching a practice or even some of the warm-ups that we could see in other practices, you can start to go, who's probably going to be on the travel roster? Because, again, you can suit up everybody at home. Everybody is not going to play in a game at home. Mm-hmm. Everybody's not going to play on the road either. But generally, if you're road trip worthy, you're also a chance that you make an appearance on the field at home. So that doesn't necessarily give you the pecking order at every position, but you kind of see who's getting the 1-2s or 3-2-ish type of reps, and you know who you might be drawing from for this year. And you might get a hint, too, at who's popping, who's like, oh, they like this guy, and depending on how much he plays or doesn't play, you'll notice like this might be somebody they're high on for the future as well. Usually that's more of the freshman.
Definitely. Definitely. And I think we saw that Saturday with Jack Paris. Like, Jack Paris is a second-year linebacker from Chicago. Didn't play last season. May have gotten some special teams work. I can't remember in a few games. But didn't play. And to me, from what I was expecting to see, got a lot of run with the ones and twos. Like, a lot. And so I was kind of surprised by that. I don't think he's in front of certain guys. We know that Coach said that Robert Edmondson is out until game week, so he wasn't going to start practicing. It would probably be like this Friday starts quote-unquote game week for them. So that's leaving some openings for some other guys to play more snaps. As I mentioned, Daniel Brown wasn't going with the full go in this practice, probably just protecting him for the season. And so that gave extra snaps to extra guys. So acknowledging that, somebody like Jack Paris, like, wow. This kid, second-year linebacker, they like him. I know they liked him on the scout team last year. Like, maybe he's somebody we need to remember who number 38 is. You know, it's that kind of a thing at practice. So those things were kind of fascinating.
offensively, Colin Dixon at the wide receiver plate, at the wide receiver position, Colin Dixon was going with the ones. That's no surprise. Yep. Hudson Clement was in a green shirt, which means no contact, but he was fully participating, mm-hmm. just do not touch him kind yep. of thing. And Jayshon Platt was not participating in practice. Don't have anything more on that. Again, that could be just what you brought up. Hey, you're a more of a veteran, even though you're new.
Mm-hmm.
Jake Renfro, center, did not participate mm-hmm. Or didn't participate fully. So you don't want to draw too many conclusions off of one day.
Yep.
But it because Jayshon Platt did not participate, you noticed that Ty Robinson, another newcomer to the wide receivers, did a lot more. Does yep. that mean he's a one? I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that for sure. But you notice, look for him. He might be a travel roster guy. He might be in that rotation.
Oh, definitely. I think Robinson took a full step forward when it was announced that Alex Perry was out likely for the year, maybe back in November, but likely for the year. You know, a guy like Robinson, taller, 6'3", 6'4", fills that role that Justin Bowick filled last year, kind of a receiver. And I think, you know, with Perry out, who they brought in to replace Bowick, if you will, I think that's, you know, he might have gone from 4 catches to 37 catches on the season just in that. With Perry out, he moves a full slot forward. So it's as I always say, depth chart is so hard to read at these practices because you don't know who's out, who's injured, who's not injured, who's just being held out to be safe. Who's being held out of, like, we're going to give you this practice off, and we need that guy to get 40 snaps on film so we know exactly what he can do. So, really hard to judge that. But yes, we did learn a lot about how the, you know, receivers, or like a guy like Nathan Cicci. Coach had mentioned how he's been running with the twos, was the quote. Here's a guy who was headed to an Ivy League school, flipped to Illinois this summer. True freshman receiver, and suddenly he's out there with the twos on so many. He caught at least 4 balls that we saw. And when you see that, and he's catching those, and it's not some of the other true freshmen, it's like, ooh, need to pay attention to that. That's probably a thing here, you know. If he's getting snaps in front of Naz Rankin or Kenyon Alston or any of the other freshmen, we need to pay attention to that. Because when they go further down the wide receiver depth chart, we might see number 19 instead of some of these other guys.
Sure, the secondary is pretty locked down for who's in front, but you saw a lot of reps for young guy Caden Considine.
Yes, yes. Again, part of that, you know, the play of the whole game of if Bailey's not participating in this practice, then the 2 is the 1 and the 3 is the 2 and the 4 is the 3 kind of thing. So hard to read, but yeah, he did kind of give those kind of Matt Bailey late recruit to the class. Is he a safety? Is he a linebacker? Or is he just a football player who makes plays kind of a guy? And yeah, I think they're going to absolutely put him on that track.
Which also he was playing in that position, the Matt Bailey position, the chief.
Yes.
Which is the whoever has the ball, go get him.
Yes. Yes.
And tackle them.
Yeah, that's why Matt Bailey does have these practices. He has one job. Go make 31 tackles.
I mean, it's a little bit like backyard football. We don't know what they're running. It doesn't matter. Just like the best guy, just go tackle him.
Yes, yes. So that's part of the, you know, they obviously need to find Bailey's backup at that position. The other hard thing to read at some of these, and that I was trying to get a beat on Saturday, is okay, so if Bailey is out, they just take him out for the series, do they then move Resetich over to that spot and then someone else comes in at Resetich's spot? It's the old thing of, like, you can list a starter and backup at strong safety and a starter and backup at free safety, but it might very well be that the backup at strong safety is the starting free safety because they slide over to strong and then the backup there moves in. So it's 3 guys. It's either Bailey and Resetich, or it's Resetich and this other guy if you're pairing those. So that's kind of one of the things that, like, you'll see a guy getting a ton of reps because he's with the twos and the starter is out or whatever. He's really like the 5th safety, but he's just there that day. So it can get confusing trying to source it. And so I was trying to get an idea of, you know, what is Makrasetic's role in this defense, and how many different kind of roles do they play? So that was something to watch. One thing I can say about the secondary is it was interesting. Okay, we've talked before, 3-3-5, right? So you got five defensive backs. Illinois defenses have had five defensive backs in the past. I'll use the 2022 defense and the example of, if you got a free safety that year is Kendall Smith, you got a strong safety that year, it's Sidney Brown. You got two corners that year, Spoon and I guess it was some X, but it was some, was Tony Adams still around in 22? I can't remember. But then Quan Martin was the star. And so at times he was a safety, at times he was a slot corner, at times he was almost a linebacker. You know, there were just different positions that they had for the star in that defense. I wanted to know how this defense works with those extra five defensive backs. And it really does feel like there's two outside corners. There's a guy in the middle who does everything. And then there's almost, like, if it's Xavier Scott and Makrasetic starting in those last two spots, they're a bit interchangeable. Like, there's a bit of a, yeah, he's a slot corner, and yeah, he's a, we'll call it free safety, but in essence, they do the same thing on either side of Matt Bailey, and sometimes they're just dropping into three safeties and that type of thing. That's what this defense brings. I just kind of wanted to see it on, you know, we've seen it. You watch film from other teams. You watch Iowa State's, you watch the old Lobos defense or San Diego State defense when they use this. You've seen this on film. It was just interesting to see it with the player rotation because Xavier Scott becomes, we talk about Matt Bailey and the Chief. Well, Xavier Scott is Swiss Army knife then. You know, I think he could go outside and if they're in a look that just requires a lockdown corner on the outside to the one main receiver, I think they would slide him out there. If they have a look that needs like a safety looking safety kind of thing, I think he can do that as well. So I think I came away thinking like, wow, X is really important this season. So is Resetic in making this defense work.
Let's talk offensive line. Jake Renfro, the center, did not participate. Again, he's been in college football since Newt Rockne, so
yes,
he may be taking a day off to keep the legs fresh.
Yep.
It's clear to me that TJ McMillan is the backup center, but to your point, you move guys around. What happens if this guy goes down? It's not always a one-for-one sub. Sometimes it's, well, we're going to move the right guard to the right tackle or the left tackle becomes the left guard and we'll put somebody, maybe not left tackle, but you know what I mean.
I understand.
Again, it's an experienced offensive line that does not have a lot of experience together.
Yes, yes. And I think I came away thinking that, yes, obviously McMillan's the backup center. I don't think he would go in at either guard spot if they needed a guard. So I'm kind of out there looking for, okay, you got two starting tackles, and those are obviously Christian Martin and Nathan Knappick. Okay, who's the third tackle? It's probably Dez Schuster now that he's back. That's what he was last year. I think he would replace both sides. Maybe Zafir Stewart would come in if they need to spell somebody at left tackle. It's possible, but it's probably Dez Schuster. And then the question is, who is that roaming guard inside? And it's probably Brandon Hansen. He was sixth man last year. He's likely sixth man this year. He's battling with Brandon Henderson for the starting job at right guard. But he also, the other name that stuck out to me, the guy that stuck out to me in person was Eddie Turk. Eddie was playing backup right guard at this practice. But I mean, he's a kid who picked Illinois over Michigan, and he spent a year at defensive line his first year, and then last year he had some injury issues. The spring he had injury issues, in a boot all spring. So this was a first chance to really see a pretty highly rated recruit, a kid who was on a lot of lists even after his sophomore year of high school. You know, maybe his third year of college football really starting to blossom. I could see him really starting to push those guys for interior snaps.
Do you know why he's called Eddie?
I do not.
It's nobody's business but the Turks.
I need that button thing that I could hit the rim shot thing. Can we add that to the, maybe just something right here where I could hit, but just something. I just need it.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll be here all week. One more. You and I were talking about it, but they were running a red zone drill, a 2-minute drill. And how Bielma runs this portion of practice stands out to you? Admittedly, I don't have the – I didn't watch a ton of the Lovie Smith practices or the Bill Cubitt or Tim Beckman practices, but this is unique. Explain it, and then I have a follow-up question.
So he is very, 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 very situational as a coach at practice.
This is something he's talked about numerous times since he got here.
Yes, and he has, I mean, you can hear him talking, just hear him in comments after some Thursday practice or something, saying, well, this was the second down, right? We're just working second downs at this practice. Like, everything is put into a situational, here's what second and long feels like versus second and short. Here are the plays we're going to run on second and long. Here's the defenses we need to, here's the rotations of players we're going to have for second and long versus second and short. Everything is situational like that. So even when they're doing a two-minute drill like they did at the end of this one, it is more for teaching the situation in your head than it is for teaching, like, hey, let's see what this exact play does. We're going to call that play, and the players are going to run that play. But the outcome of that play isn't as important as, here's what it feels like when there's 45 seconds left and you're still outside of field goal range. Here's the plays we're going to call. You know, sometimes he's even testing his coordinators, that he's calling out a situation and they have to immediately, like, oh my gosh, okay, well then the clock stops 45 seconds. We don't have a timeout, so we can't really run here. You know, I don't want to, but we're trying to run them. Maybe we do run here. Maybe we do take a run here, run the clock. They have two timeouts. You know, it's all this quick decision-making based on those types of things so that the players and everybody else knows, here's what that feels like. I mean, look at the final drive of the USC game last year. Look at the bowl game final drive. Look at Luke Altmaier. Luke Altmaier in the final drive is 3rd and 6 at like the Tennessee 13. But if they don't pick up the first down, Tennessee's still going to have like a minute left when they get the ball back. So what do they do? They do the fake clap, a fake thing, two Tennessee defensive linemen jump. That turns 3rd and 6 into 3rd and 1. They easily pick up the 3rd and 1 with Kagan Fagan, and now Illinois runs the clock all the way down to 3 seconds left, kneels it out, kicks the field goal from, you know, chip shot, wins the game. They are constantly working those situations at practice, constantly working through what's the down, what's the distance. I mean, he would even surprise players with, he tells them the outcome of the play after, it's kind of a walkthrough-y kind of thing where what they're doing on the field doesn't matter.
Yeah, ball snapped, they start the play, then he blows the whistle and he say, here's the result of what happened, even though they didn't get there.
Yes, and then they're immediately responding to that with, you know, I wrote about this one, like they were at the 21 or something, and he just surprises them with, that was a touchdown. So now everybody's got to scramble, right? Like, if the guy over on the sideline who is on the line for the extra point team isn't paying attention, oh, they're at the 21, they're doing little chunk plays as they work their way down the field. He wants that guy to go into a complete panic of, where's my helmet? I'm supposed to be out there right now. They just said that play was a touchdown, and now we've got to kick the extra point. So it is constantly working those scenarios.
That reminds me of Kevin Harlan, the great football, well, he does a lot of sports, great football announcer. He always coaches announcers to say, any play, any time. Mm-hmm. In other words, as an announcer, be ready for anything that could happen at any moment. Same goes for the guys on the sideline.
Exactly the same.
Here's my question. In the world of football, you get most of your training before college and your high school.
Mm-hmm.
And you play games. But yet guys are coming in needing this kind of training. And Bielma has looked up as an example of nobody does it better. I mean, Big Ten Network was there on Saturday, and Dave Revson tweeted about it. Like, he pointed out what you pointed out. And this is a reason that Illinois is so good in one possession games historically now under Brett Bielma. Yes. My question is, why isn't PJ Fleck or fill in the blank running practices like that? It doesn't seem like it is, you know, some Yoda thing. It seems sort of obvious. And I'm going to say this, Robert. I don't think PJ Fleck is a dummy.
Mm-hmm. Let me just frame that by answering with other Illini coaches and what their practices were like.
Okay.
Ron Zook, it is very simple. It can be described in three words: on the hop. Ron Zook would say the words "on the hop" 150 times every single practice. He wanted practice at a peppy pace. He wanted, all right, we're going to individual. Let's go, let's go, let's go, boys. Let's go, let's go. On the hop, on the hop, on the hop. Like, and they have to run and sprint down to the end zone where the blocking sled is. And that type of frantic, like, oh my gosh, what, oh, you know, his philosophy, I would guess, if you sat down with him, would be like, that's how you prepare readiness, is that you never let them just like, oh, we're just going to sit over here and chat about something on the sideline because I'm not in on this play. He wanted this hyper-aware kind of practice. And so it was just constant. Let's go on the hop. Let's go on the hop. That's one way to do practices. And you don't really do much like, all right, let's pause. As you saw, that last drive that they were doing with the two-minute drill was almost a walkthrough. They weren't really even running plays. This was just situational football. How do we do this? Ron Zook would never do that because it feels too relaxed, right?
Mm-hmm.
His theory, right or wrong, was, you know, put them on the edge kind of thing.
Yeah, and again, and there's more than one way to be successful, and mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that other coaches don't teach situations. It's just yep. such an emphasis for Brett Bielema, and it has paid off in such big ways
yep.
because, by and large, even look at the NFL, games are getting closer and closer. Offenses are getting better. We just know how to football better.
Yes.
As an evolved species.
Yes. Now, here's the other thing, is like, other coaches would enjoy going live with practices. So say, just put it like, there's 10 minutes left of practice. Some coaches are, if you're doing a walkthrough there, your tackling is going to be terrible. Put in the third string offense so you're not worried about those guys getting injured, and let the first string defense tee off on these guys, because if they're not tackling at that intensity, then they're not going to be ready for the first game. So that's another one of those, like, here are different ways to go about it. Of, you know, how do you structure your practice? If there's one thing for a Brett Bielema practice, it is found in his football 101 class that he does with all of his players, that he wants their brain never to leave situational football. I think there's no chance Illinois, you and I talked about this on Saturday, the play where USC scored too early. He is so set on how the clock works that I don't think there's any chance Illinois would have thrown to the end zone. I think Luke Altmyer wouldn't have thrown if he had a wide open receiver in the end zone, because the risk is you left time on the clock for the other team to get the ball. And as we saw in the bowl game, they just want to work it to where, oh, fourth and one, and we're in field goal range, and Olano could make this 48-yard field goal, but we're still going to leave 2 minutes for Tennessee. They would rather go for it, and if they fail, lose the game, then kick the field goal there.
I slightly disagree. I also know I'm not a head coach.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm down by a touchdown, if I need a touchdown and mm-hmm. a touchdown presents itself, I go get it. And I will worry about the next, because another opportunity for a touchdown doesn't always come up. But that's an argument for another day. Mm-hmm. But it is, I would say, both sides are totally valid.
Mm-hmm. And it shows why PJ Fox is going to handle things this way, and Bielema handle things this way, and every other coach sets up their stuff differently, because there are different things that are important. And yeah. if you want one thing that's important for Bielema, it's the situation.
Yeah. I'm just saying, the case of the Music City Bowl, you need a field goal. Much mm-hmm. more attainable, a little more, less risky, if you will, to
actually,
let the clock go
down. Let me put that to you, because I was going to ask you that on Saturday when we were talking about this. So with the situation that it was, we're at the 31. There was like a minute 30 left or a minute 50 left or something like that. Fourth and one. You can kick it and take the lead. You can get the points and take the lead. Or you go on a fourth and one. If you don't pick up fourth and one, Tennessee can kneel it out and the game is over. And you just passed up a go-ahead field goal in field goal range. What would you have done? Take the points?
Okay, how automatic do you feel the points are? It's, what's that, 48, 49-yard field goal?
Mm-hmm.
I can trust David Alano to make that,
yep.
but I don't know. I'm not knowing the wins.
Yep.
What did he do in pregame? Bah, 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 bah. Mm-hmm. It's also a bowl game,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot more to win and less to lose.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like if we lose this, we lose a playoff spot.
Sure. Yep.
So I think there's a little more – what the heck,
mm-hmm.
let's go for it kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think Bielma does so well, regardless of what Scott Beatty would do in that situation,
mm-hmm.
is he's already rehearsed that with his staff. When we're in this situation, this is what we're doing, boys.
Yes.
It's like the, I have a small fascination with those shows that show you what happened in an airplane incident,
mm-hmm.
and what goes on in the cockpit, and then they like try to reconstruct and like, where did this go wrong? Well, there's a whole bunch of like checklists, and if you're in this situation, open up to this thing,
mm-hmm.
because people have gone through it before and then they know, and they're not just saying, oh gosh,
yeah,
left engine is out, now what do we do?
Yeah.
Like, oh no, wait, we know what to do. They've also drilled it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there's a whole lot of, hey, straw poll here, who wants to go for it when we get to mm-hmm. the 31?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, we know exactly what our team can do in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
Did I deflect the answer?
No.
Is that what I just did?
No, you're fine. You're fine. Maybe I should hold you to it. What exactly would you have done? Take 48-yard field goal, but it leaves 2 minutes, but you take the lead, and then you're just going to rely on your defense to prevent them from getting to field goal range, or go for it, get closer, hopefully run the clock all the way to 3 seconds and kick the winning field goal.
With the 2025 Illinois defense,
mm-hmm.
I'm going for it.
I think that was the right call. It ended up being the right call because they kicked the winning field goal with 3 seconds left.
I know. It's like, you know, is that like walking out to mm-hmm. the coin flip and you call heads and it lands heads? And like, see, I told you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you just make a reasonable choice.
Yep.
I go back to the Michigan game on the road in 22.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, or maybe it's fall 21, which it was.
22 was when we. Michigan kicked the field goal to win at the buzzer.
Yes.
Up in Ann
yes,
Arbor.
Yes, that's where it was. 22, yep. Yes. And everyone's like, you'll remember better than me. There was a moment, handed the ball to Chase Brown, mm-hmm. and he didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was like, why didn't you do this? Or what? I don't remember if it was a punt or a field goal situation or a go for it situation. Do you remember?
I don't remember that specific, what was happening in the game.
Yeah. I just remember that they handed it to the best player mm-hmm. on offense
mm-hmm.
in that game for Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And the execution didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I was like, you put the ball in the hands of a playmaker. It didn't happen. What are you going to do? You can't just sit there and go, well, then it was the wrong decision. That's called outcome bias.
Mm-hmm.
If you decide whether something was good only based on the outcome,
yep,
and not what the options were at the time.
Mm-hmm. I remember Bielma catching a lot of heat his first season, the Rutgers game. So Illinois was driving against Rutgers, similar scenario, went for and forth, tried the little flip to Chase Brown, like hand it inside or fake it inside, and just the 90 flip from the Rams in the early 2000s. And the corner stayed home, didn't bite on what he was supposed to bite on, and made a great play. Bielma after the game was like, I trust that play and I would call it again. That kid, I don't know why he wasn't fooled. He basically guessed to stay outside and was right, and great play by him, and it cost us the game. And he caught a lot of heat for that, for exactly what you're just saying. Like, the outcome was bad and Illinois didn't pick up the first down and therefore didn't win the game. But the decision was probably still sound and he would still go with that. It's just a kid made a hell of a questionable, guess and gamble on staying with Brown on the outside.
Yeah. The 21, the Purdue game, Bielma elects to punt instead of going for it. Go mm-hmm. for it. You ice the game. You win. Punt. You're putting it back in the hands of your defense.
Mm-hmm.
Purdue wasn't doing much all game long, but suddenly executed a last-minute drive and wins the game, and he takes a lot of heat. And it's like, well, to me, there's validity in going both ways there, but at some point, players have to make plays. And I promise you, when decisions are sound, as you just said,
mm-hmm.
after the post-game comments, coaches of all types and all sports will still put their head on the pillow and agonize and say, what could I have done to put my yes. players in the best situation to win?
Yes. And if Brett Bielma were sitting here listening to the conversation, I'm sure he would say he was questioning the Maryland game that year, the Purdue game, and the Rutgers game in 2021. He said, here's how I do things, and these are the decisions I make. He has basically stayed by that. I mean, he's changed on going forward on fourth down as the data has, you know, come out and out more and more. But he has basically stayed with this, like, here's what I do, and I play it safe. And yes, we have a 7-point lead at Minnesota, and you saw 3 runs and a punt, and you're frustrated because you're like, well, just throw the ball. You know, they know you're going to run. Well, the worst thing that could happen in that situation when our defense is playing that well is to throw an interception and give them a 20-yard field. So it's 3 runs and a punt if it has to be, because that's the smart decision. And as the years played out, and as 8 wins happened, and as then 9 wins and 10 wins happened, it has proven that following that has really benefited Illini football.
So anyway, it was a pretty good open practice, huh?
Yeah, yeah. We learned that we're going to learn about the defense in the first game. I think I can say this. I think they're going to gamble more.
Yeah, you've said that a few
for the
times
person
now.
Who yelled at Aaron Henry from the stands the last few years of saying, like, why is the safety just sitting back there doing nothing?
Okay, but whoever you are, you cannot yell for them being risky.
Yes.
You wanted it this way. Now, yes. For those of you who didn't yell, be my guest.
Yes. It's going to be more volatile. Let's just put it that way. This is going to be a much more volatile defense.
And by the way, this person shall remain nameless, but I'm aware that there's a person in your life mm-hmm. who is known for yelling
yes.
in his or her section.
Yes.
So much so that some people have changed sections.
They are a passionate human person who went and sat in that exact seat on Saturday. There's a good feeling coming out of this practice. It's organized. It's well set up. You know, the offensive line, we don't know much, but Christian Martin looks like a left tackle, and Jake Renfro looks like a center, and Nathan Knappick has really been developed to where I think he's really going to be a thing. And, you know, there's a professionalism to it all. I don't know if it's going to be as good as the last 2 seasons, but there is a very – look what Dave Rebson tweeted. Like, this because of this stuff is why Illinois is who Illinois has been in the 2020s. This type of practice, this type of crisp professionalism is what has gotten them there, and it continues.
And it's why I think, however you want to project the year, it's part of the reason – you can raise the floor, or keep the floor, I should say, of win total despite a huge roster turnover.
Most definitely. Yes. I think that says it well.
We're going to talk more football in our next episode. Martin O'Donnell will be our guest. He knows a little bit about football and about being passionate about it.
And about Rose Bowls.
So we'll talk to him about that. But one more item before we get to our guest, Chris Thomas. The non-conference schedule for men's hoops is out, fully unveiled. A lot of it was already known through reporting or from the school announcement. There's no new power opponent that is part of the complete non-conference schedule. Do you remember it's 12 games now? Because you can play a total of 32 games in the regular season, so there would be 20 Big Ten games. The one that I think was kind of known but was officially unveiled with this schedule was Black Friday of November, because mm-hmm. Black Friday's in November, you know. Mm-hmm. November 27th, it's a home game against Western Kentucky. So the Hilltoppers are added to the schedule. And then the December 29th, I don't know what you call it, it's that first game back from the holidays, and we want to play somebody not in the Big Ten instead of a Big Ten team when that schedule resumes. So that is Seattle, and the whole schedule is out. You want to know it in full? Okay, fine. You open up with Fairleigh Dickinson. How's the weather today, Robert?
It's Fairleigh
Dickinson. Penn at Texas Tech, we knew that. Sam Houston is in on Friday the 13th of November. The game at Duke. Eastern Illinois on November 20th. Winthrop is in the State Farm Center. Western Kentucky, the UConn game in the United Center. Then there's a gap in the calendar right now between December 4th and December 20th. Presumably, that's where one or two Big Ten games. It'll
yeah.
be 2 Big Ten games? Okay.
Yep.
Bragging rights on Sunday the 20th of December before Christmas. And then after Christmas, the 29th is Seattle. Then the Big Ten schedule would resume, but don't forget there is that January 30th game against UNC in Nashville. What does it all mean?
The things that stick out to me, one is the Friday the 13th thing, because that's the UCLA game.
For football, so yeah.
Might have that scenario of, like, I remember the Kraft Fight Hunger Bowl was going on at the same time as basketball at Purdue, I want to say, something like that. We've had a few instances of this over the years. Of
there was one, I think it was the Texas Bowl also.
Uh-huh.
2010-ish.
Yeah.
2011-ish. It was a Texas or Heart of Dallas or something like that. And then Hoops was in, I want to say, Iowa or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's, so that'll be both of them on Friday night at the same time. And then the other thing that stuck out to me was that there's these exhibitions, not just one. But
I'm glad you brought that up.
Three of them.
Yeah, and two of them are in the State Farm Center. The first one's on the road, a true road exhibition game at Cincinnati, October 17th, and then a home exhibition against Baylor and a home exhibition against the UIC Flames. So this is new, and the NCAA has expanded that you can do this now. It used to be two exhibitions, and you could be two public or two secrets or one secret and one public. This could be a rabbit trail. I'm just saying, nobody could ever explain why the secret scrimmages had to be secret in terms of the results and all that. I get it's behind closed doors, but that's, I never got a satisfactory answer, and maybe that's why they just said, whatever. You can do three exhibitions if you want. So they're going to do a true, go through the mechanics of a road trip to Cincinnati and then two home games.
Yeah, I'm most fascinated by the Baylor home scrimmage. I mean, partly because get your hotel rooms now if they're not already gone. Because somebody could come see an exhibition against Baylor on Friday night and then football against Oregon the next day on Saturday. So that weekend of the 23rd and 24th of October, put that in ink on your calendar. But yeah, I'm this is new, right? Like it used to be when I was growing up, they would play Marathon Oil, you know, like they would play those like kind of not all-star teams, but like former college players. And they could do something like that and get some practice.
Athletes in action.
Yes, yes. They would do all of those kind of things. Now there's a true preseason games, right? Like, it made me wonder, I wonder if football would ever do this. Of like a week before the old jamborees in high school. Maybe there'll be a little jamboree with Purdue and Indiana some year.
Oh, I'd love it if they would do that in football. But again, that's another... We've taken up quite a bit of your time already.
Yes, yes. But yes, I like it. I'm a big fan of the North Carolina game. Get your tickets for that as well, because the Tennessee game in Nashville was so much fun. There had to be 6,000, 8,000 Illini fans there. They do those games in Bridgestone Arena just like bragging rights. Half the arena is going to be Illinois fans. Half the arena is going to be North Carolina fans. Get your tickets now because it's a blast.
All right. We got to talk some volleyball. It starts on Friday against, speaking of, Cincinnati. They must have come up with some scheduling agreements. Soccer's played Cincinnati. Volleyball's playing Cincinnati. Basketball's going to play Cincinnati.
Had to have.
Football's going to play Wisconsin and Luke Fickle. He used to be at Cincinnati, you know.
You tried.
I tried.
Not this season, though. You're going to confuse everybody. I think we play Wisconsin this year.
Not everything can land, but that's all right. Okay, Chris Thomas going to join us right here at the table. We will talk the upcoming volleyball season with him in just a moment. Light the Eye is brought to you by Logic Coworking, Champaign-Urbana's home for coworking, the ideal place for you to get a project completed, to study, or as a remote office environment. It's bright and airy, and the staff is friendly, and if you're a member, you can enjoy 24/7 access to their best-in-class amenities, including free printing and fast Wi-Fi. And there's daily passes offered if you just need a chance to to retreat or get away, and students can do so for a discount. If you're looking for a more permanent place to work, you can book an office. Plus, there's conference and event space. Logic Co-working, adjacent to the Bake Lab and Napoli's Restaurant at the corner of Neal and St. Mary's in Champaign. Logic Co-working, supporting Light the Eye. With us here in studio is the head coach of Illinois volleyball. It's Chris Thomas, about to begin season number 10, which is this Friday when the Illini host Cincinnati in Huff Hall. Get your tickets now. And Chris is here for a little bit of a season preview. Also, your debut on Light the Eye. You've been here 10 years. This is still a relatively new thing for me.
Yeah.
You and I have talked many times in other capacities, but welcome to Light the Eye. Hey, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it, and happy to talk about the season here.
Before this started, the Armory is a bustling place, and your court is across the street in Huff Hall, but even you have parking challenges here on campus.
Yes, and especially with the students coming back, happy to have them back here. However, makes it a bit of a struggle for the rest of us. So, yeah, we got a couple spots over at Huff between about eight staff members. So it could be a challenge, but we'll figure it out.
What's the feeling? You know, it never gets old, right? What's the feeling a few days out now before the start of the season?
Yeah, they actually gave us a week early this year, kind of some back and forth last couple of years with this week zero that volleyball's been experimenting with, just like they did with football. And so now they just opened up everyone to start a week earlier. So we started at the end of July this year, which is new. So we've been practicing for a bit longer, which we appreciate. Don't have to kind of go through the grind of the double day, so to speak, even though we'd still do those, but it's maybe not quite as intense as it used to be. But yeah, we've been training for almost 3 weeks now, and looking forward to getting underway here this week against Cincinnati and Syracuse.
Longtime followers of volleyball know this, but maybe much to the consternation of head coaches, the time you get with your players leading up to the season is one of the more limited windows of any sport in college. So 3 weeks, you know, there's not a lot of other sports that only get 3 weeks with their players.
No, that's, you know, that's a challenge we all face. It could help if you've got, you know, a more senior-related team that's been around you for a while. You know, now the transfer portals don't do us much favor because there's two transfer portals. You know, we get a group that comes in the summertime, group that comes in the winter, spring. But it's all part of the gig, and it's all part of the challenge. And it's been a great group so far, and they've really come together well in a short period of time. And all that's left to do is play someone else.
We've talked to other coaches, you know, talked to the new softball coach, and we talked portal and, like, how do you keep everybody from going to the SEC and, you know, all this kind of stuff. With the Big Ten having the reputation in volleyball that it does, in your experience with the portal so far, is there a lot of interest of, like, hey, that's the league I want to be in? Like, is that a selling point for the Big Ten?
Yeah, it definitely is. And, you know, I think that's the challenge then becomes to recruit against everyone else,
yeah, right?
And, you know, you're definitely seeing some separation with the Power Four conferences in that regard. But specifically with the Big Ten, you know, as a couple of years ago, you add, obviously, the four West Coast schools, and you get into their perennial powerhouse situations and
sure,
regional and all that other stuff that goes along with recruiting. But as you look at our roster, we're international, we're all over the country.
Yeah.
And it's just where you have to start to look, you know. Now with the addition of RevShare NIL, you're allowed, you know, you can get some more players from overseas where traditionally they might stay and try to play pro and whatnot. But it's really one of the premier leagues. It is the premier league, in my opinion, especially with, you got Big Ten Plus, you've got our games go out on Volley World TV afterwards or whatever it is. And, mm-hmm, you know, kind of just going down that list of what all the media coverage is now. You know, look at me, I'm on Light the Eye podcast.
That's right.
Worldwide. That's right. Uh-huh. Worldwide.
That's right.
Who would have thought?
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. That's right. What, tell me about international recruiting. So I know that, you know, people will, any coach at Illinois brings in an international recruit, especially from Europe, everybody's like, well, maybe Brad Underwood, when he was over there, just, like, dropped in a note, you know, because the basketball team has been known for international recruiting. What's, you know, tell me about international recruiting, how it works now, if it's similar to basketball, or is it, you know, a lot of those athletes are now looking to come to the United States.
Sure.
What's that like?
Sure. The interesting story about Brad and being over there, when I was over there the same time when he was first over there, mm-hmm, and someone had tweeted out, it might have been you that tweeted
it
out,
was,
yeah, okay,
yes, yes,
he's in the airport.
I had a spy in the Belgrade,
yeah,
airport.
Yeah, and so he was in the airport. I'm like, oh, I should shoot him a text real quick, but I was like, I'm doing my thing, he's doing his thing.
Yeah.
So I get to the airport, and you're Europe, they have these buses that you take in between the terminal.
Sure.
You don't have the, you know, the walkway or whatever. And I get on the bus, and him or Orlando wasn't, I don't think Orlando was announced yet as the next assistant coach. They were both standing there on that bus, and I'm like, I saw you were here and everything else. So
that's great.
Yeah, I just remembered it was you that put that out there.
That's right.
But yeah, internationally, it's just a market that's always been there. But the difference, you know, for them now is there's more of a monetary reason to be here. There's the educational purpose, but I think it just opened up a big window and to see the success that they've had and others that have had, and even with our league, if you look at all the Big Ten, you look at the players that come out of the Big Ten, they go to the top leagues in the world.
Sure.
And they're playing in Italy, they're playing in Turkey. We just had another player of ours, Avery Hernandez, go play in France. Mm-hmm. She's going to start her first season. So, you know, the games really become worldwide, and just as everything else, you know, we're going to look everywhere to try to find the best that we can.
Yeah, we talked to Brad Dancer about that, of, you know, how, you know, some of those players that were right on the edge of, like, start playing the lower tournaments, turn professional, this and that, are looking at NIL like, well, maybe I'll play in the States for a few years. Is it the same with volleyball? Like, are there just more interest coming?
Yeah, more interest. And you know, once one starts coming, and two and three, and all of a sudden the word gets around that it's a pretty good league. It's, you know, I can tell you that the travel is much nicer than when you go over. The locker rooms are much nicer than when you're over there.
Sure.
So I just think word starts flying around, and all of a sudden you get piqued interest from other places you may have never heard of or seen before, or like this year, we have a Brazilian on the team too. It's like, sure, there's not a ton of Brazilians that come in the league, but now there's just a lot more interest worldwide from all over the place.
And talking about the strength of the Big Ten, it seems to me if you took the best teams, the very top teams of the ACC or the SEC or the Big 12 and the Big Ten, they could all win a national championship. But I wonder about the 10th and the 11th and 12th teams in each of those leagues. It seems like, is it fair to say Big Ten maybe stronger there?
Yeah, I think so, and you know, I've been in the conference long enough to say that now. You know, it's year 10 for me, and when I first got into the conference, it was not 18 teams, obviously. I think it was 14 still. maybe there's 10. No, it was I'm not that old. But when I got in the conference, it was like, oh, yeah, okay, this night's a little easier, that night's a little easier. Okay, we had a little bit of a break here in the schedule, and you had that breathing room. Now it's a dogfight every single night, and, you know, you can't fall asleep anywhere. You got to be prepared to go. So from 1 to 18, and if you look at results throughout the years from any one of our conference matches, not just ours, but anyone, you know, you're gonna see a team who's 16th in conference, and you're with 2 weeks left, and your tournament life's on the line, and they're good still. They might have had a bad run. They might have had an injury. They might have had to figure something else out because of that injury, and they get the benefit of not giving a you-know-what anymore, and they're going to come. They're still just as good to beat you. So it's really a dangerous conference in that regard, and you know, I usually get to that speech at some point during the year. A third of the teams are trying to get bids. A third of the teams are trying to make the tournament, and another third of the teams are out of it, and they still want to beat you just as bad, and they're good enough to do it. So you really can't fall asleep, and I really do think from 1 to 18, the toughest conference in the country.
Well, let's go right there, because I'm sure it's a talking point going into the season, and will be again in November. The Big Ten is going to have a postseason tournament for the first time. The top 15 of 18, right,
yep,
will be in this format. What transpired to bring this about from the head coaches?
So we'd actually been talking about this for about 5 years, probably 4 or 5 years, before we decided to say, hey, this is the year to do it. And there was a little bit, you know, on the internal side to, you know, should we wait another year? Should we try to do it last year? And it just felt like the timing was right overall. The expansion of the teams, you started to see how the schedule affected everything. You know, Commissioner Petitti's been very high on volleyball and trying to get us into more spaces, as you see with the outdoor matches and everything else that end up happening, you know, putting more matches on TV, so on and so forth. You know, and the biggest thing for us as coaches, it was like, let's get an equal play amongst everyone. Let's just play everyone once, 17 games. Play everyone once, home and away. You're going to switch every other year. And it helps with a little bit of the compression of the season too. You know, the downside of that potentially is that you got to stack more matches in pre-conference play. So we have a lot more midweeks, as you see in our pre-conference play, that you may not get as much time to train in between. But, you know, I think we'll take those trade-offs and kind of see where it goes. But I think it's exciting for the sport, and I think you're going to get a real big draw out in Fishers, Indiana for this tournament.
I do think it's, I see a lot of benefits to it. You mentioned there's six teams, more or less, that are almost locks in the Big Ten. If you're in the top six, it's almost no way you're not making the NCAA tournament. And the next six, if you're plus 500, you're obviously in the conversation, if not also almost a shoo-in. So there might be some teams that are like, I don't need this tournament. I'm going to the NCAA tournament. I'm probably hosting, you know, pick your powerhouse of the year that year. But yet there might be somebody in the bottom third is like, okay, I got one more chance here to play my way into a postseason.
Yeah, and that's another reason I think we all liked it too, because like I just explained, you know, a little bit ago, it's like, you might be like, I'll say it out loud. We've been one of those teams. We've consistently been there. Like we're playing meaningful matches with a week or two left. And if you knew you might have one more match, maybe it alleviates some of the pressure from that the players feel about it. But it's for us, I think it's like, if you can get in and, or like I said, you might have had, let's take last year as an example. You know, a lot of people don't know this, but we had some injuries that kind of hit us in the middle of the season and kind of lost stride a little bit after having a very nice first half of the Big Ten. It's like, okay, well, then we got healthy towards the end, but it was too little too late. And so I think for those situations, I think it really does help. And, you know, that you still have that ability to get in, and you might be good or might be a good matchup, and you know, you're going to be able to make some noise heading into potentially your tournament bid. So I really do like it for that as well. And it's, you still have meaningful matches because those are going to count for something. You're going to have, even if you're the 15th team in, let's say, you can still make two match run and bump your RPI and make a good, make it tough on the committee to choose a team to get in there.
And one more on the flip side, if you're, how many matches are there again this year in the regular season?
17.
Okay, so let's say you're coming in as the number one seed in the Big Ten tournament, and you're 15-2, and you've won the regular season. Should you really be complaining that you got to play a tournament that's almost meaningless to you? I mean, like,
no,
so
you'll get the double bye or whatever it is, and the other reason why we liked it too, you're crowning a true champion. You know, we kind of tracked this over the last couple years where it's, here's your 20 match schedule. You would have 14 one plays and you'd have two double plays. Last year, as an example, our two double plays were the toughest in the conference. So, whereas like the spread was quite a bit. Like it was like your win percentage of teams that you played, that we played, was almost 700. The win percentage of other teams played was like 350 because of your double plays. And so we're trying to even that out too. Mm-hmm. You're just going to play everyone once, and then you're going to crown an actual champion. So if I win the conference with an easier schedule, are you crowning that champion, right? And that's again why you get the college football playoff and everything else, Big Ten championship and everything. So for a lot of reasons, a lot of the coaches like it, not all the coaches like it, otherwise we wouldn't be doing this right now.
I'm going to shift to a really dumb Robert question, but I have to ask this volleyball question. I have a friend whose daughter plays out west. He says she is a libero. I have other friends who say libero. What is the correct pronunciate, or is it just in volleyball circles?
Everybody says our, if you come and you look at our whiteboard at our practice gym, we just call them bros.
Okay, just bro. That's good. Is there a? I mean, is it just like regional that people use the name differently, or is there?
Yeah,
an official?
I think it's like anything. It's really gonna have libero. I think it's it's Italian. I know it's Italian.
Italian. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So you gotta lean in your European players.
It means free.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So they're a free sub. They don't count towards your substitution. So that's where it came from. They can run in and out. They have to run in and out for the same player. They can't go in for different players. But
Robert learns about volleyball.
Yeah.
And now you know.
Yeah.
the more you know. So tell me about this roster. Tell me about, you know, just give me a general overview of the season. Got a lot of newcomers.
Yeah.
You know, tell me what you're looking
for. Yeah, we had a lot of newcomers last year, a lot of younger players. And we knew we were, you know, when Reyna was graduating a couple years ago, we knew we were going to have kind of this turnover here. And so we had a young roster last year, an experienced roster last year. And now we've, 12 return. We got six newcomers, a couple transfers mixed in there, like I said, with some foreigners and some freshmen as well. And so I'm excited about it. Good volleyball players, great people. I've been doing this for a while now, and it's like they got to be really good kids. And I call them kids. I know they're not kids. They're outstanding young women, but we're around them a lot, and so they're an enjoyable group. I think the crowd's really going to see that this year, where they really like to compete, and they're a very fun group, and they compete hard, and they They're just great people, and it's, I'm really excited about the season. A lot of good pieces, a lot of players that, you know, I've always wanted to do kind of an international roster, not per se in terms of having more international players. There's different rules once you go play international volleyball. You have to play, or professional volleyball, you have to play with different substitution patterns. So NCAA, we get 15 substitutions per set. Internationally, you get 6, and you can't go back. You can't go back and forth like we do. Mm-hmm. You just get one in, one out, and then you're done for the set. And so I've always had this thing where it's like, we're really trying to develop kids much beyond their career here. Take the Reina Terrys, take Avery, who I just said went to go play overseas, Jess Nungy, Micah Allison. I mean, go down the list of our players that have played over. Obviously, Jordan's still playing as well. But in those positions that I mentioned, where you've got the Reina Terrys and the Avery Hernandezes, you have to play 6 rotations. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. You cannot survive overseas if you can't pass and play back row. And so we've always wanted to train them that way. We always have trained them that way, and are going to continue to do so. I think just the addition of everything and transfer portals and able to look at more players, we've been able to acquire a few more of those players that have those skill sets. You know, as opposed to developing over a course of time. We're always going to develop, but I think we got a nice roster that we've got some good international style players.
And then I'm sure the 5 to play 5 rule is, you know, changing all sports. So I guess, what are your thoughts on that? You know, it probably opens the door for some people to play an extra season that have been on the roster and this and that. So tell me how that is affecting.
Yeah, you know, a bit like when we got the COVID rules, and all of a sudden you get a 5th year. The difference is you don't get to expand the roster. So now you're living within your roster limits, and mm-hmm. you have to be able to deal with that. And so, and I told the seniors that are with us, or I told the players that are with us, like, let's just really be good about focusing about this year. And, you know, if you have some consideration about grad school and everything else, for sure we can talk about that and maybe see where we're at. But I really want to be good at just about focusing on where we're at right now and going from there. But I think, you know, I've heard this talked about for a bit. I know it came up in our head coach's room a couple of years ago or a year ago. And I think, you know, when you look at some of the rules that some of the sports had, I think it's football that has, you can play 4 games in a redshirt. You know, that's really hard to try to design your roster if you can all of a sudden just bounce out of it. You know, our sport, you play 1 point, you're out.
It's a year.
It's a year. Yep. Or if you potentially get injured halfway through the year, it's a year. And so I think it's good. I think it's good overall. And, you know, allows them to alleviate some of the pressure and the stress from their coursework and everything else. But as long as it fits in within that realm, and all of a sudden they don't, you know, not the magic 8th and 9th year waivers, I think we'll be good. I think that's what rubs some people the wrong way. And if it's just, here's 5, that's it, let's no longer talk about it and go from there, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Going back to last season, you mentioned the hot start to the first half of the Big Ten campaign. I think it was something like 7-1, and had beaten Purdue on the road. And then in the back half of the season, you know, was disappointing. But as you said, there were injuries that, for obvious reasons, weren't very public, but that contributed to what happened. So being that coaches always preach in the moment, do you want your players looking back to anything last year, either as fuel, motivation, or look at what did go well, that's what we need to get back to kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. And like, one of the things that, okay, like you said, okay, we've got some things, and it's not excuses, it just was what it was. And we hit the second half of the conference that was a little bit tougher than the first half in terms of how the team started to develop, as they always do. And so, you know, what I told the team, though, in our winter meetings and even as we first started the season, I'm like, you know, guys, we were 13 points from winning 6 different sets in that second half of the season. And, you know, if you look at our Penn State
13
scores,
divided by 6,
yes,
right?
13 divided by 6. So we always say 3 sets by 2 points.
Yeah.
3 sets by 2 points. And so we lost 5 sets by 2 points, and we lost 1 set by 3 points. Within that run, that includes Wisconsin, Penn State, Minnesota, and I'm like, you know, if you turn that match potentially, and that's the momentum of our sport, in my opinion. And so, it was really just like, guys, we got to figure out how to score 2 more points, and, you know, let's really go on that journey of how we do that, you know, mentally, physically, emotionally. Like, we were close, and you know, that's what eats me as a competitor, as a coach, where it's like you're so close to doing some really good things, but you just fell a little bit short. So how are we going to get back on the wagon, and how are we going to be able to, you know, keep riding and keep going on forward? And they've done a really nice job of really focusing on the things that are important to what I think is winning volleyball, and like I said, added some new pieces, and we're excited for it.
One stat that stood out to me was, I think you took the most attacks in the Big Ten, which is the most swings. But if you're taking the most, that means a lot of them aren't.
Yeah, turning, you gotta kill them.
Yeah, they're not turning into a point, right?
Yeah.
So you know what goes. You know, to me, if I'm standing in front of any attack, I'm dead meat. But high level volleyball players, if you don't do it precisely right, what's the difference between a good swing and a winning point swing?
Yeah, I think you're all, like any sport, you're looking for that combination of risk reward, and so there's going to have to be times that you take those risks and you're going for the point. There's other times where you've got to keep it in play, because otherwise you're not putting yourself in a good position. So we've got, you know, like I've heard it in some other sports too, you've got like red light, yellow light, green light, where if everything lines up, go ahead, take a swing. You know, I'm not gonna fault you if you took a good swing and missed by a little bit. But if you're taking a red light situation or a yellow light situation trying to score, then that can be a problem. And at the same time, you can't have too many of those situations. You need to be able to put the ball in the right spot to take more green light swings. And that's one of the things we felt that we weren't that great at. We've in terms of getting some out of system sets, you know, your setter's your main quarterback, so to speak. But if the setter digs the ball, or if the ball goes to a place where the setter can't dig, you got to have someone else jump in there and set a ball that's hittable, green light situation. And that's one of the areas that we really focused on and got a lot better at.
Give us a few names that we're going to hear this year that we maybe didn't hear last year, you know, from what you've seen in preseason practices.
Yeah, they've been competing hard, and it's been really nice to see. And we've been mixing and matching every single day. And, you know, you had a lot of the returners that are coming back, you know, Alyssa Aguayo and Taylor DeBoer and Kenna Phelan, you know, those names that you've heard, Taryn Kirsch. But the incoming that I think are going to do some damage, or I've seen so far in the spring and some early summer practices here, is Peyton Chapman, transfer from Tennessee. She's a true six rotation player as an opposite, and she can hit on both pins. She can hit front row, back row. She reminds me a lot of Reyna, where she's got good power to her game. She's learning how to use some of the finesse to her game as well. But she's the name that you got to look out for. Maya
and
Harris,
she gets the player former team.
Yes, she does. Yeah, that's right. Next Tuesday. Next Tuesday. Yeah. She's looking forward to that one.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Maya Harris from Angola, Indiana, and she had a nice prep career, and I think she led Indiana State of Indiana in aces her senior year, and she's a nice server, really good ball control. It's been a nice addition for us. And yeah, I'm and Christina from Ukraine, who came to us late in the summer. We were working on that for a while, but she's a nice middle blocker that can really do a lot of damage. But they're all very good. I can mention every single sure. person on our list. Like to me, yeah. This is by far the deepest team that we've had, where I feel like I can throw anyone out there and I feel fairly comfortable with what they're going to be able to do.
So when you have that, do you in some of these, you know, non-conference matchups, do you feel like you can experiment a little bit? I know you're playing a few yeah. smaller schools and such. Do you expand that to see what you
yeah.
have and then tighten it up?
Yeah, we've been trying to have some open scrimmages and practices and stuff like that to try to put more pressure on them. You see some of that there. You know, see how they respond. You know, the freshmen respond like freshmen, or they step up and play. How does it go once you put people in a jersey, and how do you feel like once they're comfortable with everything? So I'm always going to look for spots to put people in. Obviously you're out there once the records start going, you're going to want to win, and you got to make sure you feel comfortable enough in those scenarios. I'm not sure I'm throwing them in at 22 all
mm-hmm, sure.
in yeah. the fourth set to close
yeah,
out a match.
Yeah,
but if you had some space to do it, I'm always going to look for that, whether it's going your way or not. And hopefully it does go your way and you're able to get some people some time. But if you can go the other way too, I feel comfortable if it's not going our way, or it's not someone's day, or the matchup's not working out, I'm going to feel fairly comfortable trying to make a change to see if I can change a match where maybe we haven't had that in the years past.
Sure. Thanks.
Before COVID, many people remember that Illinois was pursuing a hockey program and a hockey facility and would have been in downtown Champaign. Might not remember that that would have also been a competitive space for gymnastics and volleyball and wrestling. Since that all did not happen. For the first time, we heard from Josh Whitman a hint about something with volleyball. And but he said at his media roundtable in the summer that they're in the exploratory stages of a training facility, maybe a joint one with wrestling. And Huff Hall is a historic, wonderful building, but I'm sure it presents challenges for a modern Division I volleyball program. How excited are you about the prospect of a training facility?
Yeah, very. I, like you mentioned, you know, as we started with the parking,
we could just get parking.
Just stop right there. No, at the end of the day, like, you know, we get more time to train with them than anything, and I still think Huff's is one of the greatest competition venues out there. And so if it is whatever the plan ends up being, if it is the training and we still compete at Huff or whatever that looks like, you know, I do think you need to look at some new spaces. And we've talked about it over the course of the years. And so I'm glad that that's, you know, we're finding to a space where we're out loud and talking about it a little bit. That means we're a little closer to doing it. But at the same time, it's like the gym everywhere is, you know, 900 square feet and the net's still 7'4" and 3/8" or whatever it is. And, you know, we're here to play ball. So it would be nice to have the space where maybe it's laid out a little bit differently and stuff like that. But I'm never going to sit here and complain about, you know, oh, I wish I had this, wish I had that. Like, we can all wish we had something else, but I really want to be good with the team that wants to be here and play for us here at F Hall or outdoors or out in Mars or whatever it's at. So we'll be here to coach them.
One of your colleagues, Katie Halteen, head coach of soccer, had said, "Comparison is the thief of joy." I'd never heard that before, but I thought that was an apt word.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we can go look, wish I had what someone else had, but we don't. We have really good people here. We've got really outstanding people here, outstanding support base, outstanding student body, administration that supports us every single step of the way. And, you know, when
podcasts
like the eye,
yes.
You know,
large golden orange.
That's
eyes.
Right. That's right.
That's right.
But
that's
it's, you know, when it comes time to move potentially, we'll do that. And that's just, you know, and Josh has always known that I'm in it for the long haul and in it for whatever needs to be done. And he's done a tremendous job of lifting all the sports. You know, when I first came here, there was, I don't know, 10 people in the stands of Memorial Stadium. Again,
yeah. Yeah.
But I'm not too far
Robert,
off.
Robert was
yeah.
one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just amazing to see everything that's gone on and to be a part of this and to see it from the bigger picture landscape. And, you know, we've had some nice success ourselves and we've been always in the hunt and we look forward to keep doing that.
Huff has special memories for me because, I mean, we're right at the start of classes, right? And my freshman year, 35 years ago, you know, first thing I did, like the fourth night on campus, was go to a volleyball game. It was my first ever volleyball anything besides, you know, seeing somebody play in high school. And I was just, I remember being stunned at the number of people, the noise inside of Huff, this and that. This is 91. But yeah, it's such a, I've always said to people, like, just seeing a match at Huff just feels so historic kind of thing. You know, there's such a feel in that building of the history of what was there, not just, you know, volleyball, but basketball and everything else that performed there. I know everybody wants a shiny new facility, but I'm one of those, like, man, put me underneath those rafters in the upper level there, the weird seats, and let me think about what it was like in there in 1937.
Yeah, yeah, like, you know, I've been here in 10 years now, and day doesn't go past where I feel like this is my home, and this is what I feel comfortable with, and I, you know, we have alum that come back all the time, and mm-hmm. like, I'm thinking about it, I'm like, I'm starting to tear up, because I'm like, I got, like, Jordan Poulter's coming back, getting inducted in the Hall of Fame mm-hmm. Here in September. She always wants to come back and talk to the team, and once she's like, and I talked to her about, like, hey, if you ever, you know, let's go back and let's pretend like we had NIL. She's like, nope, not changed my decision. I'm staying right there. Loved where I was at. I wouldn't trade it for the world. And it's just stuff like that. It's like, you know, when you get people that really want to be there for the sake of, you know, what matters. And Huff's an awesome venue. Like you said, if you've been there and you've heard thousands of people cheering, it is loud in there. It is very loud in there. And we want to keep it rocking and keep it rolling, and it's a great place to watch a match.
And I just saw a couple of reminders on social media of the history of Illinois volleyball and what this program's meant. First was the first televised Big Ten network match of volleyball was Illinois hosting Wisconsin in Huff Hall. That was back in 2007. Yeah. And then you had posted, or maybe the program posted yourself and former head coach Don Harden, who's still here in town. And I don't know if he's still teaching, but for a while was you know, teaching classes, and just the tradition and kind of the warmth and extended family that it is. You go all the way back to the early days of it and Mike Hebert's era, and then Don, and now what you have. And you just see that the, you know, buildings are buildings, but what happens in them, and the it's meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I'm now old enough where I've got players that, you know, I've gotten married, having kids, you know, go down a list of that. And you know, it means a lot to me when they come back and you know, want advice, or they just come back to say hi or something like that. And so we've had some really nice players come through, but even better people. And you know, I know everyone's going to remember some of the names I just mentioned: Jordan, Ali Bassanelli, Megan Cooney, Jacqueline Quaid. Like, go down the list, but like, it's really cool when I see, you know, a lot of those other players just like who played huge roles on those teams. Like, we're coming up now on the 10-year anniversary of our Final Four team and everything else. Mm. Like, and when the guys made the Final Four run, we were talking about, like, we had a text chain going, like, hey, and if it's people started spitting out their memories and everything else that they had from it, it was great. And so when I get, you know, texts like that, or when I'm just still able to have those or connections, they come back, we're camp. You know, it's like, that's stuff that means a ton to me, and it shows that we're having an impact on them much beyond their time here with us as a player out there in Huff Hall.
I just went and looked up while we're sitting here. I want to know who the opponent was back in the opener in 1991. It was against Eastern. You play Eastern this year, right?
We do. We play there.
At Eastern. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I remember this because... So the score, obviously the old scoring.
Yes.
Illinois lost the first set 15-6 to Eastern, but then won 15-6, 15-3, 15-1.
Okay.
And I remember that fourth set of, like, Eastern couldn't even score. You know, yeah. It was just this, I don't know, it's this foundational thing for me as a freshman of, like, wait. You know, I came here because I want to go to football games and basketball games. I didn't realize all the other sports could be that much fun, you know? So I just remember I was in Forbes Hall, so it wasn't a very long walk back across of just, like, man, this is, like, for a sports guy, this is, maybe I'll go to maybe I'll go to a softball game next, right? Well, you know, whatever, yeah. Kind of thing is, like, that is a, you know, I always encourage people to do that, because, you know, from now until May, there's going to be a lot of great competition.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, you know, everyone's coming back, you know, with that. We're right across the street from all the dorms still. It's like,
yeah.
That's one of the things you don't get anymore. You know, with all these venues now that are being built, everything's miles off campus, tough to get to. We're still right in the middle of everything, and that's something that when I came here, I didn't know a ton about the university itself. I was here as an opponent for 4 years in an assistant in the Big Ten. All I knew was the iHotel and coming over to Huff. And then as I came here, I was like, I was really amazed. Like, everything's just right here. And you're telling me you've got, you know, 50,000 students just right here.
Right there. Walkable to Huff. Yes. Yeah.
So it does help with their entertainment. It helps, you know, get fans in the building. But it's been great. And we love it here.
Yeah, that's great.
Friday night, 7 p.m. first serve against Cincinnati, and then this Sunday against Syracuse. Good luck figuring out which team is which. Color scheme, but Syracuse is here for a noon matchup on Sunday, and then next Tuesday, the 1st of September, you'll go to Knoxville. So it's coming quick, coming heavy at you.
Yep.
Word of advice, I know you didn't ask, but just I think it will be key this year, the serving and the passing.
It's like you've heard me say that before. I don't think I know because I've seen it evolve over the years, and you know, it's a power game right now. And so you see a lot of action front row, back row. You know, these women are touching 10 feet plus. You know, if you gave them a tennis ball or basketball, they could probably dunk. A lot of them could probably dunk. So it's pretty physical out there. So enjoy having fans out there. Please come watch us play. Let's stuff Huff every single match and go from there.
Thanks for being here, Chris. And you're just across the street, so you're welcome here anytime.
Hey,
as long as Jackson will let you come in.
All right. That's great.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Chris Thomas with us here on Light the Eye. once again, I admire your restraint. When he said that he has players that are jumping 10 feet vertically, you withheld, mm-hmm. did not say, oh, I feel like I could just go jump 10 feet right now. You know,
I mean, part of my brain is like, I bet I could jump. I bet I could touch 9 feet. I'm just going to leave it all alone. I'm not going to say things like that anymore. I have learned my lessons in life.
You know, iron sharpens iron here. Mm-hmm. You've changed. You're showing more restraint, mm-hmm. less impulse. And I've somehow I've improved here in my life from knowing you.
How?
Another episode. We'll figure that out. Yes. Another episode.
Okay, good. Good.
Anyway, go check out Illinois volleyball at Good Old Huff on Friday night.
It does make me wonder, could I get the net on a basketball hoop?
Oh, I definitely could back in high school.
I mean, I touched the bottom of the basketball? Room once. No. I mean, it's like fourth grade.
Yeah.
It was all tennis in high school.
All right. I wanted to, this is the time of year, it's been coming out for a couple weeks, the watch lists.
Yep.
I don't know if you caught this. This came out today, and this is the absolute best. There is something called the Joe Moore Award. Mm-hmm. It goes to the best offensive line in the country.
Yes.
Division I of football. And there's a committee, and they study the offensive lines, and they say, you're the best unit. And that's already a very, no individual shall stand out.
Mm-hmm.
Live together, die alone, offensive line, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Today, the Joe Moore Award, college football's only major honor for the most outstanding offensive line in the country, today released its 2026 preseason watch list.
Okay.
You know who's on it?
The University of Illinois.
You're right. And so is 137 other teams.
Like the watch list is every team?
The watch list is every team. They said the tape will show us who wins.
That's amazing.
Isn't that the most offensive line thing ever?
Look, it's for those who put little social media clips together for like East Tennessee State. I guess they're not Division I. Let me come up with somebody else. For Troy, Troy can make a little graphic now that says Joe Moore watch list offensive line. 2026.
Exactly. So I'll be looking for the press release from Illinois to say their offensive line's on the watch list.
Has made the watch list. That's incredible.
But like, we're not going to sit here and predict who's a good offensive line. So just like all of us, does Illinois have a good offensive line? The Joe Moore Award Committee is asking the same question.
That's amazing. Like, I want that to happen for everything now. Gosh, every single offensive line from every single team is on the watch
list. Yeah. Like, if you're a quarterback, you should just be on the Davey O'Brien, right? Is it the Davey O'Brien?
Yes.
Yeah.
I guess it's a satire on watch lists. That would have to be what it is.
It is,
right?
A little tongue-in-cheek, isn't it? But it's also a very offensive line vibe right there. I love it.
Yes.
I love it. Speaking of offensive line.
Yes.
Martin O'Donnell himself tomorrow.
Fantastic.
Excuse me, on Thursday's episode.
Yes. Yes, I'm ready for it. I'm excited.
Oh, I also want to say, before we go, our thanks to our hosts here at the Center for Innovation and Teaching and Learning, to Logic Co-working, to our presenting sponsor, the U of I Community Credit Union. Thanks to our editor, Caleb Podgursky. And for Robert Rosenthal, I'm Scott Patey. We'll talk to you again the next time we... Like the eye.